Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 10, Digital Cameras Continued. So just a quick review from some of the material that we went over last week. Remember that we talked for a while about the focal length multiplier, or the crop factor essentially, that exists because sensors are different sizes. And remember, just to quickly go over this, a typical full frame sensor, which is so named because it's the same size as a full 35 millimeter film frame, is larger than just about every other type of sensor that we have out there. There are some exceptions, such as medium format, large format cameras, where the sensors are much larger. But in realistic cameras, in cameras that you and I will likely be most likely to own because they don't have the price tag of a small car, they will all generally be smaller than the full frame ones. So because a lens is circular, it will project a circular image against the rear of the camera. However, the sensors are rectangular, and so we have various types of sensor sizes, and we have a full-frame sensor here, which is represented by this red box, and a smaller APS-C size, or a 1.6 multiplier, or a 1.6 crop factor sized sensor, which is in the blue box. And so as you recall, because the blue box, or the smaller sensor, is smaller, but usually has the same number of megapixels as the larger one, this results in a couple of things. First of all, the field of view is much narrower for the smaller sensor. And the example that is shown here, when we have this particular lens and it's projecting an image against the back of the camera, we can see this much of the photo in it, which includes the mountain peak and additionally some of the forest and the green surrounding it. However, when we're using the crop sensor, it crops out portions of that image because the sensor is just not large enough to capture that which is projected by the lens, and so we get a cropped image. But if we were to assume that both of these sensors had the same megapixels in both of them, and we blew them up so they were the same size on our computer, we therefore get the appearance that the smaller sensor is more zoomed in, or the appearance that we are using a longer focal length on that smaller sensor. Now, a lot of people will talk about this in terms of focal length equivalence. So people will say, for example, the focal length on the smaller sensor is the equivalent of 1.6 times the focal length of the larger one. And that's a useful metric to compare the zoom factors, for example, amongst different cameras. If you know, you can compare the zoom factor of a compact camera, for example, against an SLR, which has various sized sensors in it, or SLRs have various sizes of sensors within them. But this also comes at a specific cost. So if we are to now assume that we are not using the same size lenses on all of these cameras, because it is somewhat wasteful, if we have a lens that produces an image circle that is that large, but we only have a sensor that is only this large, then you can imagine that we can shrink the sizes of our lenses. And this actually is decreasing the focal length on these lenses, because focal length is a physical measurement. But because of that focal length multiplier, we can then compare the equivalence of that lens to the focal length of a lens on a larger sensor camera. So because we are shrinking the size of the lens, that means that we have to shrink everything within it. That includes the glass, that includes all of the electronics, the motors, and even the aperture. So even though the F number is a ratio, we are actually shrinking not only the size of the aperture, but also the focal length itself. So that means that the aperture could actually remain somewhat the same, or rather, the F number can remain the same amongst different lenses that are of different sizes, but that doesn't tell you anything about the actual physical size of the aperture. And because of that, when you're using a camera that has a very, very small aperture, remember that smaller apertures mean that you have larger depths of field. When you put a lens that has a much smaller aperture on a camera that probably has a smaller sensor, because that's the whole reason we are using one of these, it gets the appearance that we have a much larger depth of field on that camera. However, we can do some calculations and figure out exactly what settings we should use on an SLR camera in order to mimic essentially that same look, that same depth of field. So you would have to increase the f-number ratio, but you're essentially making the aperture nearly the same size, or at least you're making the, well, you probably are making it the same size in order to get relatively the same depth of field, assuming that the sensors are, that the one is not ridiculously more packed or ridiculously more dense in pixels than the other. Because if you do that, then you can get some other interesting things to have to calculate in order to make sure they are equivalent. But basically, if you remember this image from last week, what we were saying is that we can actually create a scenario in which an SLR camera, you've stopped it down to make the aperture relatively the same size, or you take into account the difference in the size of the sensor between the smaller camera and the larger one. You therefore make this, the aperture that much smaller on the SLR camera, and you can replicate the depth of field produced by a compact camera. And so this was shown to just to show you that compact cameras, although we typically think of them as having larger depths of field, it's not some sort of this magic property that's inherent to them. It comes because of this physical limitation of the size of the aperture itself. And we can replicate this in SLRs. So though SLRs can also achieve the same sort of goal, they also have other much larger apertures that they're capable of. And so we discussed that SLRs, because they are larger, they actually contain many more features or many more possibilities than the compact camera, which has a subset of the features just because of technical and physical limitations of the cameras. Okay, and then we talked about ISO as well, and what actually happens when we are talking about changing the sensitivity or changing the ISO on a camera. And so this seems to have carried over from the film days when we were talking about increasing the sensitivity of film. When you put in film that has a higher ISO, we generally thought of it as being higher in sensitivity. However, that analogy sort of breaks down when you look at the actual technical reasons that this is happening in a digital camera. So in a typical digital camera, we have basically this well or a bucket that fills up with electrons. Remember, we were using the analogy of rain falling into these buckets that we are measuring to determine how bright or how dark that particular pixel should be. And what happens when we increase the ISO in a digital camera, it doesn't necessarily increase the sensitivity because these devices are already fairly sensitive. It just has to multiply out some of the variables or the values, rather, that it has already recorded. And we mentioned that, therefore, if we were to use ISO 200 instead of 100, it would essentially double, or it would, in hardware, it would double all of these values that it found. And so you could then imagine that this decreases the dynamic range that we get out of this camera, because remember that it was the highest possible number of photons that we could detect divided by the lowest number. But as we increase this ISO, there's an actual electronic change that allows some of the read noise at the very low level to become smaller. So we don't actually lose as much dynamic range as you might expect because we're doing this. But we do lose some. So as you increase the ISO, you are going to lose some dynamic range. So if you want to get the maximum amount of signal, get the maximum amount of dynamic range possible out of your camera, you want to use the lowest ISO possible. And this is typically possible in a studio setting or something where you can have very controlled lighting, for example, or even outside on a bright sunny day, you can take a magnificent picture at a low ISO, but at night it becomes much more difficult without having to use really long shutter speeds, which can be difficult for some of these things. Okay, I'm just blowing through this stuff pretty quickly. Are there any questions before I move on? When I increase the ISO, the dynamic range decreases. Right, because remember we had the equation where the dynamic range is basically the number of photons that it can detect for it to be completely full, for this bucket to be completely full, divided by the minimum amount of photons that it can read. And that's how, that's basically, it's the range of photons that we can read from that. So we, if we have the amount of photons that we can read in, then you can say that we are decreasing the dynamic range. But there's some additional details as well that I was just saying, where it doesn't decrease by half fully every time, because we're also decreasing the amount of noise that happens as a result, but just ever so slightly. Okay, so last week when we ended, we showed a video on how digital sensors are made, and I briefly showed this slide and just mentioned that there are a couple different types of sensors that are available today. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with at least CCD. These are pretty common type. We have them in a lot of compact cameras. And we have different type, CMOS, which are usually used in, or they're at least becoming more and more popular in digital SLRs. And there's actually a very large difference between the two. They're active versus passive because basically of where the light is amplified in the circuit, but we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a second. But right now, CCD is a little bit more prevalent. It uses a lot more energy, so it wastes a lot more battery. Not waste, it just uses a lot more battery than its CMOS cousins. However, it's also lower noise for basically the same size wells or the same size sensor. So that's why we typically see, or at least for the noise reasons, that's why we typically see CCD sensors in compact digital cameras. Now, this is starting to change. I think even last year we started seeing one or two cameras that are in compact form coming out with CMOS sensors, but they're still somewhat of a rarity. So because the digital SLRs can be larger and therefore it's easier, so to speak, for them to be lower noise, we will typically see CMOS sensors in the digital SLRs. But because they also use much less energy than their CCD cousins, that's one of the many reasons why digital SLRs actually have much better battery life than the compact cameras. Another big reason is the LCD screen. Having an LCD screen on all the time on the back of your digital camera sucks up a lot of juice. So when you're always reading the data off of the CCD sensor, which uses a lot of juice, and then you're also looking at the image on the back of your camera in order to frame it using the LCD, that's using a lot of juice. So you can see why compact cameras last so much less time than digital SLRs, even when the batteries are relatively the same size. So there's another one here, JFET LBcast. This is a type of CMOS made by Nikon. It has some benefits, like it's faster than CMOS, it's lower power, it's simpler, but it's not as high in megapixels just because the technology has not been developed as much. I'm still not sure where they're going with this technology, if anywhere. It might have just very well been an experiment by them to see how popular it would have been and to see if the research was worthwhile to continue developing. But just realize that if you're looking at cameras specifications and you see that, that is one additional type of sensor that we might have. All right, so I talked about some of the reasons why these compact cameras use so much more battery than digital SLRs. So from that, we can get some battery-saving tips. So AA batteries are pretty expensive, especially if you keep churning through them. I certainly recommend using rechargeable batteries if you can for your compact cameras, because it's generally easier and certainly cheaper to do. But if you can reduce the amount of power used by your camera, then you can increase the battery life. So generally, if you can, turn off the LCD as much as possible. This will help you increase the battery life. This is even true even on your digital SLRs. For many people, or I believe even many SLRs just come by default, as soon as you take a picture, it shows a preview of the picture on the back of the screen for a couple of seconds afterwards. I generally turn that off on mine, just because if I'm taking a lot of photos all at once, I know I'm not going to be able to look out of the screen and start reviewing the images right then, but I'll just start reviewing them, you know, basically whenever I have time at my leisure. And so just having it not expose, or having it not preview the photo for you right afterwards, can also be a benefit if you're taking photos at night, for example. It's not as obtrusive, it's not as noticeable that all of a sudden your camera is brightly illuminating the room or you even. So obviously using less flash will also help you from having to eat up your battery. And even if you don't use long exposures, so as you open the shutter, and the longer you keep your shutter open, the more battery it uses. This is true for digital SLRs, for compact cameras, it doesn't really matter. If you do a lot of long exposure shots, you should be ready for your camera's battery to die very quickly. Digital SLRs even, because even though the CMOS sensors are much more efficient than CCDs, they still have a problem where you can get it to quickly die, especially if you're doing photos such as astrophotography where it requires maybe an hour or 2 hours worth of battery time. You can really kill that battery quickly because of long exposure shots. Okay, so moving on from this, so just keep this in mind for now, that we have different types of sensors, that CCD and CMOS, they are two types, and they actually represent two different types of technologies as well. This idea of passive pixel and this idea of active pixel sensors, and we'll revisit this in just a moment. So sensors, we were talking before about pixel size, and remember that we also mentioned dynamic range, how it relates to the pixel size. And so if you remember, the dynamic range is that relatively simple equation of how much we can read over the maximum amount of photons that we can read divided by the minimum amount. So if you can imagine, if we have a larger pixel well, if we have a larger bucket that we can fit photons in than a smaller one, then we have a better dynamic range. Now, it's more complicated than just that, because remember, the minimum amount that we can read is limited in a way by technology. This is sort of the limitation, is the amount of noise that each of these sensors produce. So as sensors mature and as we go on, just like computers become more efficient, faster, and better, camera sensors are also getting better, because they are perhaps getting less read noise, they're getting less noise in general, and so their dynamic range is increasing, even for relatively small pixels. So we haven't yet stagnated, technologically speaking, in terms of how good our sensors can get, in terms of increasing the ISO, increasing their sensitivity to light, and being able to read it without noise. But a lot of people would argue that we are quickly approaching it, and there's actually some interesting studies online where they've tried to determine what the maximum theoretical number of electrons or photons that we can detect using a sensor, and they make claims that we are quickly approaching it in some of the large sensor well digital SLRs that we have. But we haven't yet seen that day, so I wouldn't worry about this yet. Okay. So I digress. So about these sensor sizes, pixel sizes, it's a bit more complicated than this idea of just a well or just a bucket that collects these photons. So I don't want you to be scared by this, but I just am using this to show you all of the stuff that goes into one pixel. So if you are familiar with electrical diagrams, or even not so much, you can see that there's a lot of junk going on in one pixel on an active pixel sensor. So this is, for example, just the typical CMOS sensor, and this is one pixel. This all is one pixel, and we have the light only approaches this one little tiny thing right here in the lower left-hand corner, the photodiode. That's the only thing that the light touches. The rest are transistors. So for every pixel that we have at least three transistors as well that are required in order to reset the pixel. That's the one up here, just basically to clear it so that we empty the bucket, essentially, so that we can select which pixel and we can read it, for example. And so I'm just glossing over some of these details because it really isn't important to us, and indeed I'm not an electrical engineer and couldn't really describe in detail how this process works anyway. But the point is that this is messy. There's a lot of stuff going on here, and there's only a small portion of the area in one pixel even that can detect light. And remember, each pixel, what we're talking about is microns, one or two, maybe 10 microns at the most wide, which is about a tenth or a hundredth the size of a human hair. So the photodiode, this thing that collects the light, this is the thing that actually registers and reads the light that the camera then would be able to convert into the ones and zeros, into the bits and bytes that make up our pixel. This photodiode is way, way too small. How can we focus all of the light that's coming on this entire pixel onto that one photodiode? Let's say you had something just like this, and you knew It could be large, so it could just be a box like this. And there's a whole bunch of junk in the box, and you need to get all of the light right into the center, for example, or maybe to one side. What would you do in order to make sure that all the light that would normally fill this box only goes to that one point? Yeah, use some lens, like a magnifying glass. You would probably stop frying ants for a couple minutes to actually finish this box project, but that's exactly what happens in these cameras. There's what are called micro lenses on top of every pixel that focuses the light that's coming in, make sure it falls down that well around all of this circuitry. So this middle layer here is just a whole bunch of circuitry, all of those transistors that we were mentioning, a lot of the wires that are running around, and then it falls to the bottom where the photodiode is so that it can actually record the light that is hitting it. And there's another reason that we have this micro lens. You'll notice that it's not so much a magnifying glass, which is usually kind of flat, I guess somewhat convex, but here this is a very large, bulgy micro lens. And the reason for that, remember what happens when we have a very wide aperture. When we have a very wide aperture or a very low F number, light is not coming straight through the lens and onto the sensor. It's actually being reflected and actually can come at a somewhat acute angle onto the sensor. And for that reason, just because there's some depth to this sensor, that light will not fall, even for an even bigger reason, into this well and onto the photodiode itself. So the other benefits of this photodiode is to actually help bring acute angled light. As you can see here, this light that's coming from the side would never really, well, that's a bad example. So this light that's coming here, for example, wouldn't really hit this pixel, and it helps focus it in to that one specific part. And so I was mentioning before some of the advances in technology that there have been in order to increase the quality of sensors and the reduction in noise. And certainly some of the best advances recently have been in better micro lenses. Because these micro lenses are small, just microns in size, every time they can produce a better one, and really, really small lenses, then they can focus the light better, gather more light, so these wells, so these photodiodes don't have to work so hard, so to speak, so that their performance is therefore a lot better. And so I think even recently some large... probably Canon or Nikon, I forget exactly which camera, they actually were making a big deal about their redesigned micro lenses. And the big deal behind that is that better micro lenses mean better light gathering performance, which means less noise and all of the benefits that come with that. Okay, now there's something that I want to say about the photodiode that's probably going to blow your mind. All of the photodiodes in a camera cannot detect color. They can't. They're only grayscale devices. They can detect black to white, and that's about it. And so this seems like a pretty weird problem, especially since all of you know that digital photos are in color. So they come up with this idea of using filters. They put a color filter in front of or on top of the sensor, and all of the light that comes through is filtered by that, and then the photodiode detects the intensity of that color in that pixel. So let me show you an example. We have probably three different, in a typical color filter way, we have three different colors. We have a green, a blue, and a red. And so when each filter is on top of the sensor or the photodiode, only that light is allowed to be transmitted through. So on top of a pixel with a red color filter in front of it, only the red light will be allowed through. Remember, this is varying intensity, so this could be a very dark red light or it could be a very bright red light, and that is the intensity that it records. Then it does the same thing for green and it does the same thing for blue. But there's a small problem to all of this. When we're talking about sensors and pixels, these aren't triangular in shape. Remember that we have three color filters to deal with, but the pixels are square in shape, which means that they have three neighbors. So there's four pixels sort of in a square here, or, well, obviously there's many more, but we have this square shape rather than this rectangular shape. So that means that we have to have more of some filters than of others. And this is up to quite a bit of debate. A lot of people really like to use different, or not people, but a lot of companies like to use different color filter arrays on top of each one, or on top of each of their sensors. The most common one, though, is called the Bayer filter, and it's organized like this. Blue, green, green, red. Blue, green, green, red. Blue, green, green, red. So what I'm talking about is in a square formation, blue, green, green, red. So you'll notice that they used a lot of what color filter? Green. Why did they use green? Why did they choose green? Why not blue? Why not red? That's right. So, right, exactly. So because that is how we detect luminance the best. And I was really trying to hammer this in early on in the semester that we as humans really detect the color green the best in terms of brightness. And remember that when we're talking about luminance, that green is about makes up about 60% of the image, red is about 30%, and blue is about 10%. It's, you know, plus or minus a couple of percentage points there, but that's the general idea. And so when we have this, we then have much more green than red and blue, and so the camera has a lot more to work with in order to determine the brightness of a pixel as we would see it. Okay, so there's actually a lot of different types of color filter arrays as well. Some camera manufacturers like to not have red, green, or blue. They like to have something crazy like emerald, I think. So Sony, for example, likes to have emerald ones. Let's see, I think I have a couple of color filter arrays that I can show you. Let's see. So we have, oops, that's Bayer. Oh, come on. So we have here what's called an RGBE filter, which Sony likes to use because Sony likes to be different, where they have this idea of emerald, so which looks sort of like cyan. Pretty silly, not sure really if it adds anything to the photos. It certainly seems to be more complicated in order to solve for these pixels, as we'll discuss in a minute. Oh, we have a couple other ones here. I'll probably just show this one because you'll get the idea pretty quickly. You can pretty much use any color filter array that you can recombine in a meaningful way. And so this one has a lot of yellow, which seems pretty silly to me. And so for whatever reason, we have the Bayer filter that is the most prominent color filter array, and just about every camera manufacturer uses it. Okay. All right, so now I've blown your mind and said that one pixel doesn't actually record all of these colors. So we have this pixel that records only variations of blue. We have this pixel that only records variations of green. But when you open up your image on your computer and you zoom in, zoom in, zoom in, you don't see individual pixels of blue and then green and then green and then red and then blue and then green and then green and then red. You see a recombined image where they've taken all of these individual color pixels and they've solved an algorithm that allows them to recombine these pixels into the color that it originally was. Okay, so this is called demosaicing because they mosaicked the colors before, and so they have to demosaic them in software later. And this is typically done in the camera. However, if you save it in a raw file, the camera literally reads the raw data off of the sensor, saves that into a file, and then your computer has to know how to recombine, how to demosaic that image, which involves now, as you can imagine, knowing what type of color filter was actually on the camera in order to do the demosaicing. So you will typically have, just as an aside quickly, raw converters or raw processors will typically talk about their demosaicing capabilities and how good theirs is compared to others. And this is what they're talking about, recombining the pixels, their original red, green, and blue pixels back into their constituent, or back into the combined colors that made up the scene. And because of this demosaicing process, poor demosaicers, or ones that are just not as advanced for whatever reason, can produce numerous types of artifacts. And we'll show some examples of that in just a minute. But these raw processors love to show their demosaicing capabilities and say, oh, we have the most advanced demosaicing algorithm out there. And so you can get different results for better or for worse from your by processing a raw file on your computer than processing it in the camera, just by having your camera save it as a JPEG file, for example. Okay, I digress again. So we now have this idea of all of these pixels that are constituent colors, just these basic red, green, and blue colors, and we need to recombine them. Well, we could do this sort of silly way of taking blocks of them at a time and then just averaging or combining all of the colors in some way, but that's pretty wasteful because we have all of the information between these blocks as well, where we can try to recreate these pixels. And so that's essentially what a camera does. One way of demosaicing an image is to try to figure out the color between, and we're going to use this square sensor as an example here, these upper left foremost pixels. We'll figure the color out of that pixel first, assign that one pixel. Then it will do the upper right most. So basically this idea, it figures these four out first, and then it uses that information in addition to all of the pixels that are between those two to figure out the remaining pixels. So basically we can get some color information between all of these individual pixels. So as you can see, if we have this as our sensor, we have four pixels across, four pixels up. That means that we should have 16 pixels in this image, right? It's not 16 megapixels, but it's 16 pixels on this digital camera. But because of this demosaicing algorithm, you can see that we only have 9 pixels as a result, because it doesn't have data beyond this sensor, so it can't figure out what this left bottommost corner should be. It has no idea. So we can only get a subset of the data out of it. Now, it's 9 out of 16 is pretty bad, and it's usually much less of a difference, in other words, from what's called the number of pixels that a sensor has and the effective number of pixels. So if you ever see a digital camera's rating of effective megapixels, this is what they're talking about. It's the effective number of pixels that their demosaicing algorithm can solve based on the original number of pixels that was shown in the sensor. This was pretty popular of a metric a few years ago for whatever reason. Perhaps demosaicing algorithms really were so basic that there really were differences in the number of pixels that could be solved from the same number of sensors. I'm not really sure. But that seems to have gone by the wayside now, probably because, well, people buy these cameras and say, oh, I'm only getting effective megapixels that's like half a megapixel less than the actual number of megapixels in this camera. Why is that? And so I haven't seen this rating as much, but I'm sure if you were to actually look at the technical specifications for your camera, you could find out how many pixels you're actually getting out of the number of pixels that your sensor actually has. Okay, so this is a pretty stupid problem to have, if I may say. There's a lot of effort that goes into just recreating something that we should have already had to begin with, or something that we did have to begin with. So is there any way that we can solve this problem?
Separating the CCDs.
Okay, that's actually a very good way. Digital cameras don't typically do this, but you'll typically see a lot of video cameras that do this, where they have not one CCD or not one sensor, but they have three. And each sensor is assigned some color, so green, red, or blue. Then there's a prism or some optical splitter between the three of them that the light comes in, splits it into red, green, and blue, and then each color falls onto each sensor. And as you can imagine, for digital cameras that are already relatively expensive, this could be a very expensive proposition, but this would help them recombine all of the pixels in a one-to-one manner. They wouldn't have to demosaic anything. Each pixel would have each of the three values associated with it. It would just be from different sensors. So you'll typically see expensive video cameras that have this feature because they have the room to do this splitting. They have the expense. They have the costs are covered by the end user. So that's usually a good way. That's actually an excellent way to do it. There's another way where I have not actually ever seen anybody do this, but what you could do is have like a pinwheel of sorts that spins, and there's on the pinwheel is split into thirds, red, green, and blue, and then as it spins and you expose the frame, the sensor would record the light that comes through when the pinwheel is at the red side, for example. It's the same basic idea, but it's just using one sensor instead of three. And the downside, obviously, there is that it's not actually a real-time photo. The objects have to be completely still, otherwise you will get some color variation in the sensor. But they're all very interesting ways, but not really very useful for us as photographers in order to keep costs down and in order to keep in order to be able to feasibly take a digital photograph. So there are actually different types of sensors out there beyond this CCD, they are related to these CMOS types, but they don't have this idea of a color filter array on top of it. What they've done is they've actually stacked photo sites on top of each other. So they'll have three pixels, essentially, or three photo sites just stacked one on top of the other vertically rather than horizontally. And so they have then all of this stuff rests within some silicon, and because they know the light transmitting properties of silicon, they can therefore determine where each of these photo sites should be. So for example, they figured out that, as blue light travels through silicon, it only takes about this much time before the blue light dissipates. So we have to record the blue light at the highest level here. Then when green light comes through, yellow light comes through, it travels a little bit farther, but still not all the way down. So, we can have the blue layer on top. Then down here, we can have the green layer. And then at the very bottom, red seems to travel the furthest through silicon. It's the highest energy light, and so it can travel further through this material. And so they have photodiodes at each of these vertical locations that then record the quantity of light. They're not sensors that can detect color, but they're still sensors that can detect changes in light. And so what they will do is then recombine this pixel, but they have all of that information just stacked right there. And so this is actually a really, really interesting and good way to do this. As you can see on the right diagram there, you can see that the approximate size of it. So a pixel is a little bit larger than perhaps a typical compact camera pixel. It's about 7 microns across, but it's also quite a bit thicker. It's about 5 microns deep. So it goes about 5 microns down into the sensor, and they have photo sites at each of these vertical locations. So because the pixels are a little bit wider, because they can have better light gathering capability, that means that they're generally lower megapixels. So you might typically only see in this type of sensor maybe 4 megapixels, maybe 6 megapixels, something like that. But why does that not really matter? So if we were to compare a 4-megapixel Fovean, so this is called a Fovean style, and there's actually a company, I believe the company's name is Fovean, that develops these. I'm not actually sure if that's true, but the type of this sensor is called a Fovean type sensor. Certain cameras have it. Sigma cameras, for example, are the ones that have this type of sensor. But anyway, so if we were to compare a 4-megapixel Fovean sensor to, say, a 12-megapixel or so Bayer sensor, what might be the differences between the two? Okay, everybody talked at once. So, do you have an idea?
In this scenario, there's you need 3 pixels to end up with 1 in the final.
Right, exactly. So, in the
processing, whereas the other ones so for each, and then the foveon for each pixel, you get a pixel.
So, right, exactly. So to simplify that a bit. Right, exactly. So to simplify that a little bit, every pixel from the fovean one is sharper. It has more resolution because the camera didn't have to recombine these individual color pixels to try to figure out and just try to guess, essentially. It's all it is sort of an arithmetic guess of what the original color was before it actually broke it down. So this fovean sensor might have much greater resolution than these other ones. And indeed, a 4-megapixel fovean sensor would compare very favorably in terms of resolution to a 12-megapixel Bayer-type photo. And I'll show some examples of that in just a second. Anything else that's different here? No ideas. We had a couple of people with ideas. So, right, so what about the color quality of the image?
Well, here you're assuming that, in the fovean, you're assuming that it's an exact layering process, and it really is not.
Right, exactly. So
there could be some color variations, depending on how it captures the image.
Right, exactly. So we could have this problem that comes up where there's probably some color variations in the foveon, or at least some of the colors might be noisier than others, you can imagine, because we're sort of tricking the light in a way. We're not actually recording it in a proper way. We're actually tricking the light to try to figure out where the light falls in order to figure out what type of light it is. So we could have perhaps some cross-contamination, so to speak, of colors, or if there's some sort of, if for whatever reason there's a manufacturing defect in foveon, well, of course, manufacturing defects will impact any type of sensor, but you can imagine that we might see strange color variations in the foveon sensors first. And that's a very good point. Another point about Bayer type color filter arrays is that the filters that are on top of it, remember that any time you put anything between yourself and the light source, you're going to be reducing the amount of light that enters into it. Whether this is pure glass, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to have perfect transmission, so we are going to lose a small number of photons as they travel through the color filter array on a Bayer sensor, on a Bayer type sensor, or any sensor that has a color filter array on top of it. Because its job is to block certain types of colors, you can imagine that it's also going to just slow down some of the colors that it's, or not slow down, but is going to stop some of the photons from the colors that we want to transmit through to the pixel underneath as well. This last point is certainly valid. I would say that it's not a terribly large problem right now, because many companies are working on these color filter array type sensors. Not a lot have actually developed this idea of a fovean sensor, and so we see great advances in these other types of sensors, where the foveans, these tend to have a long time between when they actually research and develop a sensor to when it's actually released. Okay, so let's take a look at some examples between the two types of sensors. And so there's a number of images here, but bear with me as we work through them. So we have here photos from two different types of cameras. We have on the left side, the left two photos are from a Canon 5D, not the new fancy Mark II 5D, but the original 5D. And on the right side, we have sensors, or rather images from a Sigma SD14, which has fovean type sensors. And so the Canon has just a typical Bayer type sensor, Bayer color filter array on top of the sensor, rather, and the SD14 has a fovean type. And so remember that we were talking about comparing the different resolutions of the two. And so at 100%, a 4-megapixel, let's say, I forget exactly, this is either, the Sigma is either 4 or 6 megapixels, but at that resolution, if we were to blow it up and crop a certain part of that image out, we see only this much of the image. However, when we blow up the 5D and look at it at 100%, we see this much of the image. So it's a lot larger because there's many more megapixels in the 5D. It might be, who remembers exactly what the original 5D had in terms of resolution? Was it 12 megapixels? It's probably around that. It's probably approximately 12 megapixels for the original 5D. Okay, but I want you to notice something on the 5D, and let's see if I can really point this out here. I'm going to zoom in a little bit. Notice that it looks kind of jagged. These diagonal lines here, they don't look perfectly diagonal. There's sort of this very faint, jaggy line that protrudes out of what should have been a very straight diagonal line that came from this flower. But let's say we took that lower megapixel sigma sensor and blew it up so that it had then the same resolution as the 5D. So what we're doing then is we're just shrinking the image to be the same size as the 5D image. What we see there is that the lines are actually much, much smoother. There's very little hint of that sort of jagged line that we see. And that's because this is a difficult situation for a sensor with a color filter array. Right here we have very high contrast area change between this pink stem and just the background, which is sort of blue. And so at that interface, where it actually changes from pink to blue, the camera's not really going to be able to determine that change exactly or precisely. It will determine it maybe another pixel or two down, but when it's sort of between these two pixels, when it's trying to figure out what that one pixel should be right in the middle, it's not going to know what it should be because it's just recombining. You can think of it almost as averaging this data or calculating the luminance from all of that data that's there, and it doesn't have that information. It's been lost because of that color filter array. However, because of the fovean, every pixel can detect each color. All of the colors that are reproduced by that camera can be detected by every pixel. It doesn't have to do any sort of recombination later to try to figure out or try to guess what pixels are between these high contrast regions. And so we get much sharper areas between high contrast regions. And so to me, this is really neat, really exciting technology, and I wish that it could be developed a bit more, but it just seems to be that it's just has not had a very high rate of adoption. Just a lot of people don't seem interested in it. And most likely it's not the sensor, but most likely it's the additional cost because of additional research that these people have to do, and also, frankly, the cameras that they're in. Not a lot of people have heard of necessarily Sigma cameras when they could just go to Best Buy or the now defunct Circuit City and just buy a Canon or Nikon right there. So they're just not as popular, it seems, and which is too bad. How much do they cost? I don't actually know. I guess we could find that out. I should probably find that out during the break. But they're probably, since they are all in digital SLRs, I think they've been talking about releasing a compact camera with the fovean sensor. I'm not sure if they have yet or not. They tend to be more expensive, so in the SLR cost region. And so now we're seeing these Canon Rebels and the Nikon equivalents that are becoming very cheap, sub $1,000 digital SLR cameras, and we're not really seeing that from this fovean competition. And so it's just sort of the problem continues, really. So that must be it must have come out somewhat recently then, yeah. If they have a rangefinder style.
I don't think it actually has a rangefinder viewfinder.
Oh, okay. But it's more compact.
It's meant to handle like
a... I think I've heard of this. I think it still has a larger sensor than a compact camera, but it has that larger sensor in a compact camera body, if that makes sense. So it's a very large sensor in a much smaller body, which is a very interesting thing, certainly. But I mean, then we would have to have larger lenses. But still, it's a very neat thing. I'll show you that camera after the break, where we can take a look at it briefly. Okay, so if we were to move on, and we can also see additionally the same loss in detail just in this green leaf. So even though this leaf may be focused on, we actually lose some resolution because there's these very harsh changes between green and white, and the camera has a tough time figuring out, especially when there's anything that's, there's any significant change in color from one pixel to the next, or what should be one pixel to the next on the sensor, we get these demosaicing problems where it just makes it sort of soft and fuzzy because it can't really figure out what color it should be at that point. So we can get higher resolution out of even an upsampled, or that means just making the image larger, out of an upsampled fovean image. Okay, so it's much smoother on the fovean. We get much better detail. And what happens many times, if you look at your photos at 100% on a digital camera, especially maybe when you first started out, you may be saying, well, I know it was focused. Why does it look sort of fuzzy? Why doesn't it look perfectly, perfectly sharp? This is one of the reasons, is that the color filter arrays introduce this sort of just very slight amount of blur because of it. And that's actually brings me to this next point, where the reason that this is blurry isn't so much. So one of the reasons is that it has to recombine some of this stuff, but they actually have to introduce another type of filter to prevent additional artifacts from coming. So let's talk about that really quick. So we have the fovean type sensor. So let's say we take a photo of somebody's ankle, basically, where there's an interface of jeans and shoes. So some track shoes here, for example. So right, especially in the jeans, you can see that we have this very high frequency pattern. And what I mean by high frequency is that it changes, like every pixel changes from a blue to a white, to blue to a white, to blue to a white. We can see that detail from a fovean sensor because every pixel can be represented by every pixel on the sensor. And so we don't get any sort of weird artifacts. We see this texture as we would perceive it in real life if our eyes were pixelated, so to speak, and we were to blow it up. But let's say we were to use the Bayer. So in the Bayer color filter array on top of a sensor, all of that light is projected onto the sensor, and this high frequency change, so from blue to white to blue to white to blue to white, every pixel confuses the demosaicing algorithm. It just cannot reproduce it in this same sort of resolution or this same sort of detail that the fovean can. So we get this maze-like color as a result of having very high frequency and on top of very high frequency color changes, and we are trying to take that photo through a Bayer color filter array. And so you may actually see this sort of idea somewhat frequently on your camera. If you take something, and you can see this even if you're taking a photo of a wall, for example, a brick wall from sufficiently far away, where there's the idea of having the brick and then the mortar and then the brick and then the mortar, and it's sufficiently small enough, you can actually get this maze-like pattern. You can actually introduce, looks like waves into the wall, and it looks really distorted and really unusual. And that's no fault of yours. It's because of this demosaicing artifact. This is just one problem that we can have because of it. But there is something that we can do to fix it. So remember that I said that we have this problem when we introduce high-frequency color changes into the photo. So what if we just remove those? We can put this filter on top of it called a low-pass filter, which means that it only allows these low frequencies through. And there's ideas of low-pass filters in various things besides photography. So there's a low-pass filter in optics, but there's also low-pass filters in electronics, which only allow low frequencies through. And the idea is the same. We don't allow any high-frequency changes through to the sensor in the back. So it has the effect of blurring out these sorts of high-frequency, these areas of high detail that we should get. Now, the idea behind that is that we reduce this maze-like pattern that is a result of this demosaicing algorithm, but the consequence of it is what? lower resolution, so it looks fuzzier. So we, even though we have these very high megapixel cameras, we are actually hurting the resolution of them because we just simply cannot acceptably recombine a lot of the data that comes through. So
is this thing optical or in the algorithm?
This low-pass filter is optical. And in fact, this is the, when you actually take the lens off of an SLR camera and you open the mirror and open the shutter to actually look at the sensor, you are seeing the low-pass filter on top of the sensor. That's usually the thing that you're seeing. So there's a variety of filters, and on top of the actual sensor itself, if you remember from a couple of slides ago when I was showing the micro lens, and then now this should make sense. This is the red portion of the color filter array on top of this photodiode. We have some additional layers on top of the sensor. So we have the photodiode, all of the electronics, the color filter array, the micro lens, the low pass filter, and we also sometimes have an infrared filter on top as well, because for whatever reason, these sensors can detect infrared better than visible light. And so if we don't actually reduce the amount of infrared light coming through the camera, you'll actually record light that you don't actually perceive, and you can get these very strange and very surreal looking photographs. In fact, infrared photography is very popular among people. It's a hack that you can do to your camera where you can modify the sensor to remove the infrared filter off of the sensor, and then you can take your camera then only will take infrared style photographs. But it's really interesting and really fascinating to see some of the photographs that result from that. Okay, so back to this idea of a low pass filter. It's on top of the camera, or it's on top of the sensor. It's one of the layers on the sensor, and we lose resolution, or we lose the perception of resolution because of it. And so we have another strike against the Bayer color filter array, despite how popular it is. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about sensors. Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about the different types of sensors that existed, and we were also briefly mentioning some of the types of cameras that come with this Fovian type of sensor. And so I went on to our favorite resource, dpreview.com, and found some of the Sigma cameras that have been released, thankfully, somewhat recently, which implies that the Fovian sensor is still alive and kicking. And so there is this camera, the Sigma DP2, which contains a Fovian sensor. It's kind of tough to get a feel for the size of the camera, but you can see that it's smaller than a typical digital SLR. However, it does have a somewhat large sensor in it. And so we'll go over some of these details in a minute. But also, there's the Sigma SD15, which is actually a digital SLR. I believe it has the exact same sensor in it. So the differences then between the two are obviously the size of the camera itself, but also the lens, where this original one that I mentioned before has a fixed prime lens in front of it. So that's, it's not that useful if you need to do a lot of zooming, but it's useful if you need a small, compact camera that has a very good sensor within it. And so then the SLR, obviously, then since it's an SLR, you can switch lenses. You can put additional zoom lenses on it if you need, or longer focal length primes, shorter focal length primes, whatever your need is. But what I wanted to point out was some of the differences in the specifications between these cameras and just a typical digital SLR. So I have up also Canon 500D Digital Rebel, who knows what they call them, T1i, who knows why they make them so complicated these days. It's basically the most recent Digital Rebel to be released by Canon. So let me try to make this text a little bit bigger. So we can see that we have a very high resolution on this Canon. We have 4,752 pixels wide by 3,168 pixels tall. And so if we do the math, that's about just over 15 megapixels, which is quite a bit. That's a fairly dense sensor, in a sensor the size of, it's this APS-C size, approximately about 22 by about 15 millimeters. And so if we were to take a look here at the Sigmas, we can see that we have just a very ever so slightly smaller sensor size at about 21 by 14 millimeters, but we have much fewer pixels. We have 2,652 by 1768, which is about 4.6 megapixels. And so going back to the Rebel, one of the things I wanted to point out was the difference between the number of photosites that we have, or the actual number of sensors that we have, versus the effective number of pixels that we have. So we have here the total number of sensors, or the number of photodetectors that are on this sensor, is about 15.5 million. But we lose about 0.4 million of those in the effective pixels because of the demosaicing algorithms. So now, for the sigma ones, this might be a little bit confusing, but not when you think about it hard. We have then sensor photodetectors here of 14.1 million, but then you realize that we have about a third, or 4.6 million effective pixels. And remember that this makes sense, because just remember that these are just stacked differently. So it's just the one stack, and we have three different photodetectors in different vertical locations. So we expect it to be about a third. But if we were to think about the number of sites that exist, this matches pretty well. We would expect there to be 4.6 million actual sites with just three photodetectors in each one. If you were to actually do the division, it's not exactly three, and that's probably because they don't tell us exactly how many pixels and how many sites there are on this particular camera, but we can assume a 3-to-1 ratio. Okay, but let's just take a look at some of the other things that are useful. Notice the pixel density, for example. We have the very low pixel density on the Sigma camera. It's 1.6 megapixels per centimeter squared. That's the MP divided by centimeter squared, whereas the Canon has a higher pixel density of 4.5 megapixels per centimeter squared. So just without looking at actual photographs from these two, we could assume that perhaps the Sigma could have a bit better noise than the Canon. Whether or not that's actually true depends on how advanced each sensor actually is. And I would wager to say that they're probably about equal, and I bet the Canon is better in terms of chroma noise, what's called just variations in color, like what we were talking about before. Because we're stacking these up, we can get higher noise in color variations. So what should be, for example, red might be slightly less red in a fovean sensor, for example. So we might expect better chroma noise in the Canon, and maybe also just general, slightly better noise in general from the Canon as well, just because it's a much more mature CMOS platform than the Sigma. But we'd have to actually look at photos to be able to make that determination. So now you can actually take a look at all of this, or nearly all of this information that's presented to you in the specifications, and figure out what it means, and use it to help you determine what camera might be best for you. So we can see that we have ISO ratings of 100 to 800 on the Sigma, and we have a 1600 extended mode. Remember, usually you want to try to avoid those extended modes, because it's just it's not actually making any better sensitivity. It's we're just doubling the photons, or we're just doubling the values of the photons in it. Whereas the Canon actually goes up to 3200 before we have to start going into expanded mode. So I actually, just looking at the two, the differences in the two, the Sigma is actually relatively inexpensive. It seems to be at a list price of about $650, or at least there's a link to Amazon for $650. And even though it's a fixed lens, it's a prime lens, it's a fixed lens, so it's not a zoom, it just seems like a very interesting camera to have in your collection, or to have in addition to another camera, because you could take very sharp photos with it in relatively good light, because remember the ISO is not as good, and we would expect some strange color differences between the two. Any questions on fovean versus bare versus any of this fun stuff? So I think this stuff is actually really interesting and really cool. This, now we've moved away from all of these general photography sort of ideas and gone into really specific detail about digital cameras themselves and really opened them up and shown what the differences are. And we can even do things with digital cameras that just sort of wouldn't make a lot of sense in the film world. So for example, there's even more types of sensors where they try to accomplish different things. So we have here, for example, a Fujifilm Super CCD, what they call a Super CCD type sensor, where we have two sensors at each photo site. And so what we have here is we have a larger photodiode, one that has a relatively large lens over it, and it's also a larger photo site than a secondary one that's of lower sensitivity. And so what this is useful for is that we have less light entering into this smaller photodiode. So that means that we could use this one to detect a lot of highlight regions. So we could use it to try to get, let me explain this in a different way. So in a typical setup where we have only one photodiode, we have this linear idea where every one photon, we increase the value within the sensor. And so once we reach the full bucket scenario, that's it. We can't actually record any additional information. And as we get close to that, then we really run the risk of losing detail because once we overexpose it, it's gone. We can't recover that detail. So what this sensor hopes to do is to actually have a smaller photo site just off to the side that's of lower sensitivity. It's harder. There's less light that travels into here so that we can capture those details that we might have lost in the overexposed regions on this larger photodiode. And so typically when we're working in raw files from this Fujifilm Super CCD sensor, we can recover details from highlight regions much better than we can, or at least in theory, much better than we can from a typical Bayer or even Fovean type sensor, where once we have overexposed once we have filled up the bucket with photons in this photosite, that's it. We're out of luck. We can't do anything else. And so some people argue that this sensor is a godsend. It brings all sorts of additional detail into highlights. And whether or not that's true, you'd have to look for yourself and compare subjectively the photos from a Fujifilm to just a typical Bayer or Fovean type sensor to see if that's true. But it certainly is interesting to note that we don't have to think in an analogous way to film anymore. We can do these sorts of crazy things with sensors to try to get the most out of the digital limitations that we have. Okay, so we need to switch gears a little bit now. So we've talked about all of these sensors, and we need to talk a little bit more about how the camera actually reads the data off of the sensor. And so to do that, I just want to quickly review some of this stuff that we've talked about before. So histograms, for example. Remember that histograms, there's many different types of histograms, and they show us information about the values in the image itself. And so what are the different types of histograms that we have? RGB, histogram, colors, or luminance rather, not histogram, colors. There might be some others as well. Individual color channels as well, which basically just tell us how much of that value we have in a particular photo. And so we talked before about dynamic range. When we have a somewhat squashed or squished or narrow histogram, we also have a scene there where there's not a lot of dynamic range in the scene. So for example, there's no true blacks in this scene. There's no true whites. And so it looks like it's a very low contrast scene. So the dynamic range of this scene was much lower than the dynamic range capable of the camera, because the camera could capture a much larger dynamic range than what was produced by the scene itself. And so we could then, in software, or even while we're at the site, widen this histogram by increasing the contrast, for example, or if we had a camera that didn't have such high dynamic range, perhaps we could retake the photo and we might have a histogram that looks like this. So it's elongated now, but you'll notice that now we have a lot of very dark regions and a lot of very bright regions. And you can see that here. We have some regions that are perhaps underexposed, where we've lost maybe just a little bit of detail in them, but it looks subjectively better. It looks contrastier, it looks more interesting, especially when compared to this very low contrast or very gray looking image. So when we're talking about dynamic range of a scene, and if you see a histogram that looks like this, I hope you took that photo in RAW, because then you can really try to expand, by increasing the contrast, you can try to expand the histogram and get more pop, more contrast out of your photos. Also, though, if you have taken a photo that looks like this and you want to try to increase the contrast even more, you're going to put yourself into a tough situation, because you've already lost some detail in the highlights, maybe not so much down here in the water, but especially up there in the clouds, and in some of the dark regions and some of the shadows here. So increasing the contrast more, you're just going to lose additional information. But of course, in the end, it's when you take a photo, it's all very subjective. It's how much contrast you actually want to have in a particular location or in within the entire image as a whole. Okay, so remember what can happen also when we talked about increasing the contrast earlier. Let's say we had this photo as a JPEG, and ignoring the fact that we're going to lose additional detail in the shadows and the highlights region, what is the risk that we have if we increase the contrast on this image? What is an artifact that can be produced if we increase the contrast of this image, and if it was a JPEG image especially? Right, we get this stepping idea. What's that called? Yep, posterization, exactly. So we lose this smooth gradient of colors, or this smooth transfer. You can see it everywhere as the clouds turn from gray to white, for example. We lose that, and you start to see these additional steps as the gradient changes from one color to another. And so that's another thing that you have to watch out for when you are increasing the dynamic range of your photo in the scene. And so this is one of the reasons why we recommend RAW. And we've been talking about this and talking about this and talking about this, but I've never proven to you why RAW is better. And that's what I'm going to do right now. So with that teaser, I have to make you work a little bit more. Remember, bits and bytes. What is a bit? It's right there. What's a bit? One or a zero? It's on or off. Light bulb on, light bulb off, doesn't, however you want to think of it, it's a zero or a one. A byte is then 8 bits. And so if we have 8 ones or zeros, we can then have 256 different potential values in them. So, okay, let's now take a big step and start talking about how a sensor can actually read some of this data into and convert it into its digital output. So let's say that we have a sensor. And so when we're talking about these sensors, they're not digital sensors, really. They have these photodiodes. They have a certain voltage in that mix of circuitry that we were talking about before. And just to simplify things, I'll say that the very bottom of the bucket is 0 volts, and the very top of the bucket is 1 volt, just to make it simpler. So when, as we fill up this bucket with photons, the voltage in this pixel increases. And so it's that voltage that the camera that we can measure to try to determine the value of that particular pixel, to determine the brightness of that particular pixel. Okay, so let's say that we have filled up the bucket a certain amount to about 55% of the way, so we have now 0.55 volts in this bucket. So what happens is that we then need to figure out a way of converting that into its digital component. And so if we were to just use all of the available bits here and just say an empty bucket is zero, is represented by value zero, and a full bucket is 255. Remember that we have 256 discrete values, but zero is a value as well. So that means that we go from zero to 255. Then we can try to figure out what value fits best from this 0 to 255 range that we have. What value within that range fits best from this analog sensor? So this sensor could actually be a little bit more, it could be a little bit less, but we have to fit those values into one of these values that we can represent digitally. So if you do the math, you can actually figure out that, okay, 55% of 255 is about 140. And so then the camera does that conversion for us, and then it outputs the digital version of that value to the processor, which then does whatever processing, demosaicing it needs to do. And so this thing in the middle, this 8-bit sampling that happens in the middle, is done by something that's called an analog to digital converter, or an ADC. You might see it in a variety of forms: A to D converter, AD converter, ADC. Any one of these plays on this acronym, analog to digital converter, is talking about this unit that converts this analog voltage, this voltage anywhere from 0 to 1 volt, to its digital component. And so in this case, we have an 8-bit sampling. So we have an 8-bit digital converter. So that means that we can put 8 bits worth, or we can figure out 8 bits worth of data from this voltage that comes from this sensor. Okay, now remember what is, so when we're talking about 8 bits, that means that we have how many bits here? Well, we have 8 bits, but that means that we have, now, asking this in a question is more difficult than just explaining it, I think. So if we assume that we have 8 different positions of bits, that means that we have 8 positions where it can be 0 or 1, 0 or 1, 0 or 1, so on and so forth. And so we can double or halve each of this, or we can double or halve this value basically 8 times. So we have a certain dynamic range that can be represented by this digital converter. Because remember, what happens when we double the number of photons in that approaches the sensor? Yeah, it's one stop change. So that means that we can fit basically maybe 7-8 stops of information from an 8-bit sampling. Okay, but this is, remember, this is, we're doing this linearly. That means that for every time that the sensor says 0 volts, the 8-bit sampler says it's a value of 0. We're not doing any changing or shaping of this value, which we actually have to do at a later time. So just a linear 8-bit sampling, we can have about 7 or 8 stops coming out of this particular image. Now remember that you can increase or decrease the contrast. Just think of it conceptually. You can increase or decrease the contrast to fit more dynamic range into that 8 bits or less dynamic range. And don't think about that too hard, but we'll explain how we can fit different dynamic ranges into it. Just realize for now that we are just doing a straight conversion, just a linear conversion. So when we have one, when we have a value of 1 from here, that means that we have a certain number of photons. Then when we double that to 2, that means we have twice as many photons. Then double that to 4, we have twice as many photons. We've increased the number of stops by 8 times in order to get this 8-bit sampling. Okay, so let's say then, we've talked about this 8-bit sampling, so that an 8-bit analog to digital converter can realistically get maybe 7-8 stops worth of dynamic range from the sensor. Now the sensor itself also has dynamic range ratings. The electronics, remember, when we're talking about our bucket analogy, if we have larger buckets, we can have much larger dynamic range. So if we have, let's say, an 8-bit analog to digital converter, and our sensor is only capable of, say, 7 stops of dynamic range, that's perfectly okay, because then we have an analog to digital converter that can convert all of the useful values produced by that sensor. But now let's say that we have a sensor with a much bigger sensor well, or a much bigger bucket that can fit many more photons, so we have a much larger dynamic range. So now let's say we have the same 8-bit analog to digital converter, but we put a 10-bit sensor behind it. What's going to happen? Well, we can only still convert 8 bits worth of range. So even though we have 10 stops that's possible from this sensor, we can really only convert 7 or 8 of those stops to digital format. So when we increase the dynamic range of a sensor, we also have to increase the dynamic range of this analog to digital converter. And so this is seems to be one of the new things that camera manufacturers like to talk about is, oh, we have a 10-bit ADC, we have a 12-bit ADC, we have a 14-bit ADC. We really kick all the other competitors' butts right out the window. That really only matters if you have the sensor to go along with it. But certainly you don't want an analog to digital converter that can represent fewer number of values than what your sensor can tell you, because then you're just needlessly wasting a lot of the sensor's capable values. So just to put it another way, to put it more simply, one second. So if we have an 8-bit ADC and we have a 10-bit sensor, we're just throwing that data away. We're not capable of being able to read that amount of data. All of that data cannot be represented in digital form. So we're just losing that data. Yes?
If it's analog, how could you consider it limited to a certain number of stops? You know what I mean?
So if it's analog, how do we give it a certain number of, or what? How do we rate the dynamic range? So it's basically just that same idea from before, where we could have. So this is unrealistic because a sensor is going to have some voltage. It's not going to have completely zero voltage, and so this is just the same thing as that equation that we had before. We want to divide the maximum voltage by the minimum voltage that we can use to reliably get data out of this bucket. So it's not going to be zero, but maybe like 0.2 volts or so. That starting at that voltage, that's when we start getting reliable data out of the sensor. And so then if we have, let's say when it maxes out, it's at 2 volts, then we can say, okay, it's 2 divided by 10. So we have a dynamic range of 10 stops in that case. And so then all of those values in between, since it's analog, we can have any value in between 2 and 10. But when we're talking digital, it has to be very precise. So we have to funnel all of those values through an analog to digital converter and then figure out and say, okay, well, 0.2 to 0.3 volts is going to be represented by the value 1. 0.3 to 0.4 is going to be represented by the value 2, for example. It's just that's a poor example, but that's an example of how it actually will do this conversion. Okay, so let's say now that we have an analog sensor that's has slightly better dynamic range. And again, just to simplify it, I'm just going to use this idea of 0 volts to 1 volts, but it's a pretty good sensor in this case. And now we have 12-bit sampling. So we now have a 12-bit ADC. So whereas before we had 8 bits, which means, you know, we had 8 bits all in a row, which means 2 to the 8th is 256 discrete values that we could record. We now have 12 bits, and that doesn't sound like a whole lot more. But remember, you have to. We're talking in powers of 2, so we have 2 to the 8th. What do I do with my chalk? 2 to the 8th times 2. So now that's 2 to the 9th times 2. 2 to the 10th times 2 times 2, so on and so forth to figure out how many times. So we've taken our 256. Multiplied it by 2 to get 5, 12, by 2 to get 10, 24, by 2 to get 20, 48, and then by 2 to get 40, 96. So now this small increase in the number of bits is allowing us to capture way more data from this sensor. So now with this 12-bit ADC, we have 4,096 different values from which we can read the sensor and resolve the detail from this sensor, resolve the brightness from this sensor, which is really good because now 256 is kind of limiting. It just sounds limiting. It's like, I mean, I could write 256 different values very easily and have them all be represented by that. It just seems like a crazy amount, especially considering the variations in color that we have and just all of these things. So by increasing the sampling or the number of bits that our analog to digital converter is capable of, we can not only increase we can get a much better idea of the values from this sensor. So we have more values to work with, and we have a much better dynamic range. And so then you might think that posterization is much less prevalent in these cases where you have a lot more data to work with, and that's certainly the case. When you have more data, that's when you really want to talk about, or when you have more data, that's when you really are able to worry less about posterization or modifying your image by increasing the contrast, by increasing the saturation, and having to worry about introducing posterization because of just having too few values to work with. Okay, so before I mentioned this idea of reading these sensors linearly, which means that for every small increase in values on the analog sensor, we are doing a small increase in values for the analog to digital converter. And so this means something actually kind of interesting and surprising and perhaps worrisome all at the same time. That means that every time we double these values, we are increasing the stop by one. But at the same time, when you think about this, that means that every time we have the value, we only have that much data to work with for the remainder of the stop. So think about it this way. We have, at the very darkest region, we have the value 0, which means completely black. And then we have 1, which is some brightness value. Then we double the amount of, then we double the stops. We double the brightness, and that means that we now are getting a value of 2. Okay, so then now we double the brightness again. We get a value now of 4. But you notice that between each of these stops, especially way down low, there's no additional data. So this increase of one stop at this very dark level, there's just not a lot of data to work with. And we don't get to the point where we have values to work with between each of these stops until we get to this higher range. As soon as we start getting up to, let's say, 128, 256, that's when we start getting a number of values between a doubling or a halving of the light. Remember that when we are looking at light, we don't just notice a doubling or a halving of light. We actually notice variations, gradients between the brightness and the darkness of light. So we need lots of values between this doubling and this halving of light in order for it to look smooth to us, in order for this to look natural and appear to be natural. And so there's obviously upsides and downsides to this. The upside is that we can figure out exactly how bright one pixel is compared to another when we look at its raw value. We can say, okay, this pixel has value of 2048, this other one has value of 512, so we know that this, the one with the higher value, is exactly 2 stops brighter. We can use this, and this is useful especially for astrophotography, where you need to do some precise measurements on the brightness of an actual star or of an actual object in the sky. You can use this property, this sensor linearity, this property of sensors, to figure out exactly how much brighter it is. Whereas, especially when we are looking at an object, it's really tough to tell when the light has doubled or halved, and that's just because of the way our eyes work. And in fact, that brings me to the disadvantage of this. This does not mirror how we view the world very well. We don't see the world like this. Every time the light doubles, we don't have twice as many values in order to figure out what the brightness is of each of these things. Our eyes are not linear devices. We do not see the same way a camera sees. Okay, now I'm going to explain how we can change this data into what our eyes perceive as being correct. But are there any questions on sensor linearity before I move on? Does this make sense that when we're doubling the values here, we're doubling the brightness? It's twice as bright. And for that reason, we have more, as we get higher in these values, we have more values between these stops to work with. Okay. All right. So now there is this idea of a tonal curve. We have to map what the sensor perceives as brightness to how our eyes perceive it. And so you notice that we have this sort of a curve shape, and I'll explain what it does for a minute, but this is essentially mimics how our eyes perceive values. So when we're looking at dark regions, for example, our eyes spend, let me explain this differently. So before, we had a lot of values in a camera to describe these very bright regions. But when our eyes look at something that's bright, we don't perceive a lot of difference in very bright things when we're just looking at some particular scene. What we perceive as being the most difference or the highest change in these values is perhaps a little bit darker. It's not the completely bright regions. It's some of the darker regions that our eyes can perceive the most amount of contrast, the most amount of change in brightness levels. So what this means is that we have to not so much invert, but really change how the sensor's values map to what our eyes perceive. So we have here along the bottom sensor output from a 12-bit sensor and a 12-bit ADC. So that means that we have values ranging from 0 all the way to 4096. Now, if we were to just look at that data, if we were just to open up that raw file, not apply a tone curve to it, it would look very, very dark to us. It just would not look right because of, even though there's a lot of this, it's going to sound crazy, but because there's a lot of there, even though there's a lot of data up in these higher region for the bright areas, our eyes do not perceive the light in that same way. So what we see as being bright, the camera does not see as being bright. It sounds crazy, but think about it in terms of what the sensor outputs and how we should perceive it. So this sensor outputs from 0 to 496. Every doubling of this value means a doubling in the amount of light. So we apply this tonal curve to it to map what this sees as 0 value to what our eyes should see as 0 value, and what this sees as 2000 to what our eyes would perceive as being half brightness. And you'll notice here that this tone curve actually applies a lot of brightness to this dark region. So if we look at it this way, so we are outputting data from the sensor from 0 to 4096, and then we are saving all of this data into a JPEG file, which is 8 bits, so that means that we have to map these 4096 values to this 8-bit value that our eyes can, when we open the file, our eyes can perceive. So that means that when we start looking at some of this data, we're going to ignore some of this darkest data because there's not a lot there. But let's say for the first 1,000 or so values, we're going to sort of stretch their importance to our eyes. And so this value of, if you take a look, for example, maybe about here, which is about a third of the way, it maps up to, I don't know, like 25 or so. Then if we look at 1,000, and look at, see how far up it's gone. So now the first quarter of this data, if we look up here and we just sort of drag our finger up to the top here, we see that the first quarter of the data that's represented is actually important for the first lower half or so in terms of the brightness. So we're mapping these dark values to be slightly brighter because our eyes look at the world in this more logarithmic or in this more curved shape format than just very linear, very straight, and very boring. And so as we modify this curve, we can actually modify this curve. We can make it higher or lower. We're increasing or decreasing the tone curve, and we can compress the highlights and shadows. We can extend the mid-tone areas just to really make the photo look like how we would expect the photo to look. This tone curve is important to change the sensor's linear output to how we would perceive it. Yes?
Is this essentially what auto levels?
Auto levels. Let's see. Auto levels, like in Photoshop and the like, I'm not exactly sure how they work, but they probably actually just change the contrast and the levels to a certain degree. So remember when we were talking about levels, we had the histogram, and then from the black region to the white region. And sometimes for histograms that, especially if you remember from a few slides back, we had a dynamic range in the scene that was too small. So, and we would have some space on the side. So the auto levels might try to pick what the best black point would be and might stretch the histogram in that way. So using auto levels on a linear on a linear file, you probably still wouldn't see much. It would probably still look very dark. It depends on what the data looks like here. The levels assumes that a tone curve has already been applied to the photo. So its behavior would be less predictable, I think, than saying that using auto levels we'd be able to see the photo all of a sudden. I think that depends on the values that are actually contained within the photo. Oh, it's it? Oh, using auto levels on a RAW? Was it processed in any way?
The RAW files were incredibly dark. You couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. So I assume not.
But was that an exposure problem? Because when you...
No.
Okay. So it should have been bright. So it's not... clear why it would have done that. I suppose there's still a lot of variables that could go into it, I think, so we'd probably have to talk about it later. But in general, there's, even though, so the best, so another way to think of this is that typically if we were just to save all of this data in a linear fashion, so that zero, so we just had a straight line that goes from 0, 0 all the way up diagonally, so we saved all of this data in a JPEG format, what that means is that the top, so from one, so from the value 128 and up, so the upper half of this region would only be represented by the top two stops worth of data, right? Because we're having the data, I mean, maybe even the top one stop or so, because this data up here from 2048 all the way to 4096 represents one stop worth of data. So we have a lot of stops that are down here in this region, and so what you would see then is really compressed. All of this data that's here is really compressed into the darker regions of the JPEG file from 0 to 128. So what that looks like, that's why it looks very dark. Even though the majority of that data might be over here, it's going to look really dark because it's all being placed, if we were to do it in a linear fashion, it's all being placed into this lower section of the file. So this is why we have to apply this tone curve and give more importance to these darker regions where we have actually the majority of the stops. Unfortunately, we don't have the majority of the data. That's where we have the majority of the stops, which is what we would perceive and what is important to us. Okay, any questions there? All right, so the difference then between RAW and JPEG. So the bit depth for RAW really depends on the camera. 10, 12 bits, very common, very popular. 14-bit, we're starting to see more of, which means that we have lots and lots of data to work with within the RAW file. JPEG, as you recall, and as we alluded to earlier, is only 8 bits, so we can only represent 256 values at each color channel. Remember, each pixel has three color channels, red, green, and blue. Each one is worth 8 bits. And so we have... even though it sounds like, oh, we only have, you know, 2 to 6 bits less, we're actually having it several times. So we have much fewer data to work with in a JPEG file. A tone curve is not applied to a RAW file. So that means that the sensor, that the data is still linear when we come out of it. When we process that file, we must apply a tone curve so that when we look at the image on our computers, it makes sense to us. It doesn't look completely dark because that's where all of the data would be. The white balance is not set on the RAW file. We can set it when we process it, and it is set on the JPEG file. Compression, most RAW files are compressed losslessly, which means that we are not losing any data. Lossy JPEG compression means that every time we save it, we are actually losing quite a bit of data every time we save it, or I mean, not necessarily quite a bit, but we are losing some data every time we resave that JPEG file. Portability, what I mean by here is how easy is it to move this file to, say, another computer and just open it on there. RAW file is not so easy to do. They're very specific, not only to the camera manufacturers, but to the cameras themselves. So you have to have some pretty advanced software to be able to open these RAW files on your computer or on another computer, whereas JPEG, everybody and their cell phones can do it, literally. all of your cell phones can, well, unless you have a really old phone, your cell phone can undoubtedly read JPEG files and show them to you. Post-processing, that's where we take the file, we apply a tone curve to it, we apply white balance to it, we increase the contrast, perhaps, we increase the saturation. We have to do some of those things on the raw file. Like I said, we have to set the tone curve, we have to set the white balance. Most raw files, actually, the cameras will embed what it thinks the white balance should be, but we can adjust that as necessary without risking any posterization or artifacts as a result. With JPEG files, what you see is what you get. You don't have to post-process if you don't want to. Okay, there's actually an interesting thing about this idea of sensor linearity, where all of these values, so half of this file at the very top is devoted to one stop. So we have a lot of values within just one stop at the top end of this file. And so that means that you can imagine that if we come up with this idea of what's called exposing to the right, where we try to save as much data into the higher stops that we possibly can, then we would actually have more values to work with when we bring this raw file to our computer. So a typical photo might have a histogram. So this is a histogram of an actual raw file before it has a tone curve applied to it. And remember that because most of the stops are not the brightest stops when we're taking a photo, most of the stops are sort of the mid-range and the shadow regions. So that's where we're going to see all of the data, is this lower half of the image. And so if we were to maybe increase the stops on our, or increase the exposure values on our camera by maybe one stop or maybe two stops, depending on what your histogram looks like, then you can start to get some values up here, where you have a lot more variation in values, and you can record much better, much more detailed gradients in changes between color from light to dark at these upper stops, and then later you can bring the exposure down just a little bit, and you would have more data to work with. The downside of this, though, is that you really must take your photos in RAW. This does not work with a processed JPEG photo because the tone curve has already been applied to it, and it's what you see is what you get. So it's going to look overexposed. It's going to look bad, and it's only going to work additionally if you don't have like what you see here. You don't have some colors that are already overexposed. If you try to overexpose, if you try to expose to the right a little bit, you will worsen that situation, and so you could have more values to work with, but at the expense of overexposing more portions of your image. And so I find a lot of people recommend exposing to the right when you're taking raw photos and then bringing the exposure down a little bit. But I think this is only useful if the dynamic range of the scene is somewhat small. If it's not very large and you are absolutely sure that you're not going to overexpose anything, then go for it. You'll have more values for each of these stops. You'll have more data to work with, and you can actually manipulate the image to a much greater extent with a reduced worry of artifacts such as posterization and other artifacts that could result from having all of these. And also, in terms of the sensor itself, it's much easier for it to measure the values over here. So to bring back this bucket analogy, it's much easier to measure it when the water is a little bit higher than when the water is pretty low. And so you have a higher signal to a lower noise. And so you increase actually the quality of the image if you expose to the right. Even if you don't do any manipulations, you increase the quality of the image by exposing to the right and then bringing it down a stop or two later on. Yes?
What about the shadows? Let's say, should we move, we have a low dynamic range on our picture, should we move our histogram to the right better and then we adjust?
If you have more values, so yes, so it depends again on the type of scene. If you have a scene that has a very low dynamic range, yeah, but is very dark, which I think is what you're referring to, so maybe a dark scene or a night scene of some kind that doesn't have a lot of lights that cause blooming, then yes, it certainly is recommended to certainly overexpose it a little bit without losing detail. Remember, as soon as you you blow the color channel, or as soon as you blow any of this data, it's gone. It's gone forever. You can't recover it. But if you, let's say this part didn't exist in this histogram, and we had a histogram that just looked like this. So remember, this isn't what a typical histogram would look like, because after we apply a tone curve, it's going to stretch it out already. It's going to shrink this part and extend this part because of that tone curve. But if we ignored all of that and we saw this, this is a perfect candidate for exposing to the right, because then you can see that we have stops 1 through 8 way down here, 9, 10, and part of 11 is represented here. And if we do it here, then if we move it to the right, then we're increasing by great degree the number of values that we get in these brighter regions. And so you would get higher quality, you would get lower noise, you could manipulate it better. The advantages are numerous, but it's so easy to mess up. It's really easy to overexpose something and not be able to recover it later. It's so easy to have your camera set on JPEG and then completely lose your mind when you realize, oh, I really can't now bring down the exposure at all. And so when we're talking about RAW files in general, if you have actually taken photos in the RAW format and messed with the exposure slider and heard me talk about, oh, you really can't recover overexposed details, but you mess with that and you notice that details seem to be coming out of nowhere, it's because of this idea of sensor linearity and this tone curve. A lot of the data that is up in this upper region is compressed to just a few values in the JPEG file. So it looks like it's overexposed, because after a tone curve is applied, you may actually have some data left over in the raw file. So you have a lot of data here. So these values, 2,000 to 4,000, half of the raw file is compressed to simply, what is this, maybe 200 to 225 to 250. So you're compressing 2,000 different values into about 50. So you have a lot of data to work with, and that's why you can bring down the exposure slider just ever so slightly and actually recover some details. And this is one of the great reasons that that RAW is around, and why I recommend leaving your camera on RAW all the time, even if you decide to use RAW plus JPEG, because it just takes one photo where you slightly overexpose it, and it's your best photo except for the overexposure. If you can recover that, just by decreasing the exposure slightly in the RAW file that you know some manipulation that you cannot do on a JPEG file, you will love your camera. You will thank whoever you want to thank, everyone you want to thank, for having RAW and using RAW at the same time. So that's it for this week. Thank you all for coming. Oh, one question. Yes.
Just when you're talking about exposing to the right.
Yes. No, I'm talking about slightly overexposing images, if you can. So if you don't have any blown color channels, if you're not going to run the risk of overexposing something, as is in the case that we had the example over here, where perhaps it's a somewhat dark scene with a very narrow dynamic range, then you want to overexpose it slightly, because that's where all of the values are. But just don't do it too much. Don't go overboard, because then you'll actually lose data. But yes, that's what I mean. Okay, thank you. For real this time, and next time we will talk about color.